Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about banking regulation and talking a little bit about what now has been proposed by the administration, what people in Capitol Hill are thinking about changes in the way that the government oversees banks and the way that they operate. Certainly, there's a great deal of concern that we not have a repeat of the kind of financial crisis that we're still dealing with. Different people have different ideas about what's the right thing to do. We'll try to talk a little bit about what has been discussed. Certainly, we will talk about what the administration has proposed, a little bit about perhaps the reaction to Congress. The administration has said they'd really like to see something move through Congress before the end of the year. Whether or not that will happen is anybody's guess. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is George Panocki. He's professor of finance at the University of Illinois. He's been with us before on the show to talk about similar sorts of subjects. And we're pleased to have him here. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just stay focused on the topic and try to keep their questions brief if possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David.
I'm sure that there are people, economists, members of Congress, people in the White House would say that there are important lessons to be learned from what we've come through and where we still are. I expect probably, though, different people would say different things if you ask them, well, okay, what? Is there any sort of consensus about what the problem was and what we need to do to fix it?
Very limited consensus. We probably have consensus that we have a too-big-to-fail problem, that mm-hmm. we have in the financial system what people refer to as systemic risk, that the failure of one large or interconnected financial institution will bring down other financial institutions. And there are proposals to attempt to limit that, but whether they go far enough or not is one question. Mm-hmm. There were, I think, many causes of this financial crisis that we're in, and there's plenty of blame to go around. I don't think it's valid to just use any one entity as a scapegoat. I think regulators, market participants, and also policymakers, I think, also can share in the blame.
Yeah. Let me just there are a number of things that we can talk about. Let me just pick one and ask you about it. And that some people said one of the things we need to do is change the capital requirements for big banks, capital and liquidity requirements. And essentially, as I understand this, the requirements that we say to banks, well, you've got to actually be able to put your hands on this much cash if you need to, if you have a problem. And I think the suggestion is if those requirements had been higher, that these banks would have had an easier time riding this out. They would be able to sense – they wouldn't have needed to have to be bailed out because – they would have had the assets on hand that would have since cover whatever losses or whatever problems that they had. Is that, do you think, a good idea?
Yeah, I think it's important to distinguish between capital and liquidity. Those are actually two different things. Okay. When we talk about capital requirements, we mean that the funding for a bank's loans and securities cannot all come from depositors or debt, but that some money must come from equity or stockholders. And that creates a buffer so that if there's losses to the bank's assets, be they loans, be they securities, then the bank is not going to go bankrupt. It's going to have sufficient asset value left over to pay off depositors and debt holders. So that's good, certainly a good thing. We need more capital in banks, and there's proposals to reform capital requirements that close some areas that previously were not required to have a capital requirement. Now, liquidity is another issue. That's kind of on the opposite side of a bank's balance sheet, the asset side of the balance sheet. Should we require banks to hold more cash? Well, I think there was a bit of an overconfidence in the banking system, in that banks prior to the crisis thought that they could always borrow money fairly easily in wholesale markets to raise cash whenever they needed it. It turned out to be not as easy as they thought. The interbank borrowing markets seized up when investors realized that a lot of the assets on banks' balance sheets were so opaque, hard to value, that they were fearful of lending to banks. So perhaps having some regulation on how opaque a bank's assets could be, that's actually part of the administration's proposals to create more transparency.
And it seems from what I'm sure somewhere I read some actual numbers on this, it seems that what they're talking about, it's not an enormous increase in either of those things. Is just if we just bump those two things just up a little bit, would that be enough to make a difference and head off something like this in the future?
Well, you know, I don't think capital is the entire answer, higher capital or liquidity requirements. If you go back to January 2008, which is about 6 months after the crisis started, all regulators were saying, well, we're fortunate to be going into this crisis with very well-capitalized banks. So, you know, when the crisis, even after the crisis hit, regulators thought banks had sufficient capital. So I don't think capital, it can go part of the way of helping things. But, you know, there's one problem I see with our regulatory system. On the one hand, we'd like to encourage more capital. But on the other hand, we have a tax policy that discourages it. Finance, both theory and empirical work, has clearly demonstrated that there's a tax advantage for banks to have high leverage, because the interest that a bank has to pay on its debt and deposits are deducted prior to paying corporate taxes. It cannot deduct dividends paid to equity holders. And from a bank's point of view, it wants to minimize its capital because of this system of taxation that we have. And so I think there's a bit of a inconsistency with our policy toward firms and banks in particular, that we have regulators that want banks to hold more capital, yet our taxation of banks discourages it. You know, one possibility might be to move to a value-added tax rather than a corporate income tax for banks. And this would go at least partway of discouraging capital.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is George Pinaki. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about banking regulation and whether things should be changed. There certainly have been proposals made in Washington for doing that in light of the current financial crisis that we're still living through. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We've got a caller here to bring in the conversation up in the northwestern part of the state, up in Pawpaw, on our toll-free line. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Thanks, Dave. Mm-hmm. This whole thing came from people who actually broke the rules or they let break the rules. What I don't understand is that honest, hardworking people are paying the price for a bunch of people who decided to get greedy. And the government is a lot to blame. I don't care whose side of the fence you're on. The problem is now, how do we get out of it? And you just brought up a lot of good facts about taxing. Taxing isn't going to help anybody. In fact, I think it's going to make things worse. Because right now, I think everybody's nickel and diming, or if not pennying, everything they have in their house, their home, their college. I know so many people in this state that are either out of work or struggling to get by. And these are people who are middle-income people. And even some of the higher-income people are having problems. I think what's happening is the banking system and the SEC have to change the regulations. They have to start. Somebody has to go through and re-regulate or revamp everything that they have done. It's antiquated. It doesn't help anybody. It helps people get away with a lot of corruption. And I'll never understand why giving money like they're doing hand over fist to these banking companies. You know, to me, it makes no sense. They're not doing anything. I'm a contractor, and I can't get a loan for the heck of me. I've got good credit rating, and I can't get a loan. The banks are not giving it, and I have tried to go in with people who, the banks that had homes that are foreclosed on, and they don't do anything as far as maintenance on it. Yet they complain about the cost of renovating when they especially in the wintertime when all this thing was going down. They've got houses that basically, because they turned the heat off, they turned all the electricity off, they basically had floods and damage to the house because of the winter issues left and right. And then they turn around and blame other people for their mistakes.
Okay, we're getting into some different areas here, and I appreciate what you've said here, and I think you've given us a couple of things we can talk about. Let me turn to the guest and say, you know, the caller touches on something that I think is a reaction that lots and lots of people have, and that is we have these big financial institutions, and if they got in trouble because of the decisions that they made, they should bear the consequences and their stockholders should bear the consequences. And why should the taxpayer come along and bail them out? Why not just let them fail?
Okay. Well, the counter-argument to letting them fail is, again, the systemic risk that bringing down one financial institution might have a domino effect and lead to the failure of others. But, you know, I think that is the heart of the issue. We need to regulate financial institutions in a way that one institution's failure doesn't create a domino effect throughout the economy and as, you know, as the caller mentioned, cause a lot of damage to third parties, the consumers in particular. I think there's consensus on preventing one of the biggest causes of bailing out large institutions, and that's the clearing of over-the-counter derivatives by a central counterparty. In the Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns failure, one of the reasons for the systemic risk that was thought to arise from those failures were that they were large dealers in derivatives, and when they failed, that would cause losses on other financial institutions. The same thing with AIG, their failure would cause losses on many of their counterparties. Well, if they are forced to put up collateral, which happens all the time on futures and options exchanges, that would prevent their failure from having a so-called domino effect. And so I think that is one area that there is relatively strong consensus. There's a few pushbacks from over-the-counter dealers, and you can understand why, because they've profited by not having to have their trades cleared. They've not have to put up collateral. But I think from a public policy view, this is clearly something that should be done and is part of the administration's proposal. I think there's bipartisan consensus on centrally clearing derivative trades.
I guess I'm going to have to ask you to, can you back up and explain that in a way that non-finance professors can understand.
Sure.
Because I think maybe I know what you mean, but in more plain language, can you explain?
Okay. Well, David, for example, suppose you had a General Motors Corporation bond. And about a year ago, you were a little worried that they might fail and you were going to lose your money. You mm-hmm. could buy insurance against default on that bond. And I could sell you that insurance. And the way that happened was through a credit default swap.
Right.
As General Motors started to get in deeper and deeper trouble, if we had a centralized clearing between our trade, then you would have to put up more collateral. I would have to put up more collateral because I'm going to have to make a big payment to you. So if GM fails, and as they get closer to failure, it's more likely that I'm going to have to insure you. So forcing me to put up collateral would mean that if I as a firm failed, you would still be able to get your money. And so if I was a dealer at Lehman Brothers and I had given you that insurance, even though I went bankrupt, you would still get your payment. And so you would be safe in being able to insure your bond.
So now I got you.
Okay.
And I think that a lot of people have pointed to this. This was where one of the big problems was, that people were investing in some assets that had a lot of risk. And they said, well, to themselves, you know, this could go south. So I'm going to insure myself against that risk. I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy essentially an insurance policy.
Right.
And the people who sold the insurance policy apparently looked at the assets, and the way you at one time might have looked at GM, and you would say, GM is one of the most solid things that you can possibly think of.
Exactly.
No way GM's going down. So the people who sold the insurance policies, it seems that they sold them thinking that they would never have to pay off.
That's exactly AIG's situation. They wrote a lot of insurance through credit default swaps on mortgage-backed securities. Who would have thought that, you know, after decades of rising housing prices, that we would have a nationwide downturn in housing and defaults on mortgage-backed securities? And so that led to AIG's demise.
At the same time, it seemed that there were people who were packaging essentially in investments. There were these bundles of bad mortgages. They were packaging them up and then selling them on, knowing that there might have been big risk. And then them saying to themselves, well, I'm going to sell this on. It's not going to be my problem anymore. It's going to be the problem of the guy who bought them, which then it turned out to be, yes, it was the problem of the guy who bought them. But then seems to me like there is a question about some responsibility should go back to the person who sold on something that maybe they did or maybe they didn't know was a very shaky sort of a thing.
Right. Yeah, many purchasers of mortgage-related securities, such as collateralized debt obligations, which were very complex securities mm-hmm. backed by an array of complicated type of mortgage securities. The buyers put too much confidence in the rating agencies. They should have realized that the originators of those mortgages need to have an incentive to make sure that they're, you know, not going to be selling the worst mortgages. And the administration's proposal does have some provisions. They're requiring mortgage lenders to maintain some position so that if the mortgages default, that they will absorb some losses, the so-called skin in the game. They want the mortgage lenders to take some loss, and I think we're never going to see, at least I shouldn't say never, but in the near future or probably the foreseeable future, we're not going to see the complicated mortgage-backed securities that existed prior to the crisis. I think too many investors have been burnt, and they want simplicity now. Yeah. They don't want the complication.
Well, having said that, I think what you say is also true, that some people say part of the problem here was that we had these very complicated financial instruments, and few people really understood them. And do we have here some kind of failure of federal oversight? Should there have been somebody in the federal government who was looking at what these institutions were doing, who could say, yes, indeed, I understand what this is all about, and I see some potential problems here?
Yes, though I think no one foresaw the sizable downturn. And I shouldn't say no one. There were a few economists. Robert Shiller, for example, the Yale economist, was warning of a housing market downturn. But I think it's probably true that the vast majority of regulators just thought the probability of a systematic decline in housing was such a small event that they didn't worry about it. In fact, our capital standards gave preference to mortgages. A bank needed to hold only half the amount of capital against a mortgage loan than it would, say, a commercial loan. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, partly it's our I think regulatory policy, and in part that might be a function of interest groups that I think want to promote housing. We have, I think, a number of policies that might not, from an overall social point of view, be beneficial. We have a number of policies that I think promote housing in the United States, and the mortgage interest deduction, and at least in the past, having less weight against mortgage loans on a bank's balance sheet is an example.
Mm. Well, and I have another caller here I would get right to. It sounds as if, though, from what you're saying, is that you perhaps think, and there are other people who think, that the way to make sure something like this doesn't happen again is not so much into restrict what kind of things that banks can do, but rather to say to banks, other kinds of financial institutions, that they will be responsible, and that what they've got to do is make sure that they are backed up, and that if something happens like this and the bottom drops out, that they can essentially take care of themselves.
Yeah, I think we need more risk put back into the officers of banks, that if they make a bad decision, they pay the consequences, the shareholders pay the consequences, and it's not a consequence that taxpayers have to be forced to bear. There are some, proposals in the current Treasury white paper that tries to deal with this, but some people think it hasn't gone far enough. Mm-hmm. That we need to limit how much the government will intervene in large institutions, and I think that's the most important. I think in this financial crisis, the government has been much too ready, particularly Treasury and the FDIC, to come to the aid of large institutions.
Having said that, though, very quickly, are we expecting, that is the government expecting ultimately to get that money back, the money that it has invested in these institutions to keep them afloat? Are we saying that we're expecting at the very least to get that money back, if not make some money on that money? Or what do you think?
Well, there's a probability that we could get it back, and there's a probability that we could lose a large part of it. I think the probability of losing a large part of it is much greater than our getting the total amount back. I mean, there's been estimates by the Congressional Budget Office, for example, the original TARP money of $700 billion, I think They're estimating we're going to lose maybe 300 or 400 of that 700 billion. So, you know, there's some programs where you might get the money back. If the economy does better than expected, if it does worse than expected, we're going to see more bank losses. And the government has insured, for example, mortgage portfolios at Citigroup and Bank of America. And if more loans default, we have more losses.
This is Focus 580, a little bit past a midpoint. I'm David Inge, and our guest is George Panocki. He's professor of finance at University of Illinois. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, would you care to comment on the Washington Mutual bankruptcy case? As I understand it, the fellow who ran the company ran it for 8 years. He received over $8 million. He drove it into the ground of bankruptcy. Yet he walked away when I think he should have been indicted, or at the very least, the money he made should have been retrieved for the good of the bank and the people.
Yeah. Washington Mutual is actually an instance where there were no taxpayer losses. There were losses to the debt holders of the bank holding company that owned Washington Mutual Bank. But J.P. Morgan Chase took over Washington Mutual Bank, which was under the holding company. There were actually no taxpayer losses because J.P. Morgan was willing to take the bank as a whole. There were losses to the people who lent money to the bank holding company. So, you know, from that point of view, yeah, there were private investors who took losses, but fortunately, taxpayers were not in the end exposed. Now, I guess I can't comment because I don't know the specifics of Washington Mutual. I know that they were, you know, certainly the largest thrift institution in the United States. They were very aggressive in their growth strategy. They were heavily exposed to West Coast real estate, so it's not surprising that you know they took some losses because of the real estate bubble in on the West Coast.
Do you have any idea what Christopher Cox and the SEC was doing when these unregulated collateralized debts were being transacted, as well as these Ponzi schemes?
Well, they probably, like many other regulators, did not see the dangers in these collateralized debt obligations. They were, in many cases, being rated, a large part of their securities being rated as AAA securities. And I think regulators relied too heavily on the credit rating agencies, as did individual investors. And indeed, our bank capital standards were based on rating agencies' ratings. So if a bank held a collateralized debt obligation or mortgage-backed security that was rated AAA, they would have to hold less capital against that investment than some other, say, B-rated security. So, you know, even regulators, I think, in general, and this was an international consensus, it wasn't just the United States, but international bank capital standards were based on credit ratings. You know, I think the idea of securitizing mortgages, creating securities by banks selling mortgages, was a good idea, but it was taken too far. It was in part a reaction to the savings and loan crisis. One of the causes of the savings and loan failures of the 1980s and early 1990s was that too many banks were holding 30-year fixed-rate mortgages on their balance sheet and funding them with short-term deposits. And when interest rates rose, banks had to pay high interest on their deposits in many cases, greater than the interest that they were collecting on their mortgages. So in reaction to that systematic failure, regulators encouraged banks to sell mortgages. Well, you know, that was probably a good thing from a risk management point of view, but it went too far. Investment bankers underwriting these mortgage-backed securities probably didn't take into account that the banks, once they start selling mortgages, don't have as great an incentive to screen the credit of their of the borrowers and monitor the borrowers after those mortgages are made.
Thank you.
It seems that, though, there's always been a secondary market for mortgages. Was it just that that it just suddenly got out of control? It was like the secondary market on steroids. Suddenly, it got much bigger than it had been before.
Well, that's right. The market started with the creation of government guarantees by on mortgages against default. Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac were initially a public financial institution. They were later privatized, but they really started the secondary market for mortgages. And for quite a long time, it was just restricted to mortgages because they carried a government guarantee against default. After a while, though, there were experiments in securitizing credit cards, credit card receivables, automobile loans, and then finally almost any loan that was being made, people thought you could have a bank sell it and into a pool of securities and have that financed by outside investors. So I think it went too far. People became complacent. They relied too much on credit rating agencies and didn't realize the so-called moral hazard problem, that once a bank is able to sell a loan, they may not do such a good job in making sure that that loan isn't going to default.
All right, let's go on to another caller here. Champagne is next. It's line two. Hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for addressing this issue. I was interested to hear your guest call some of the issues moral hazards, which no doubt they have been. I would like him to address, please, the idea of regulatory capture and how we can perhaps take back some of the power we have given to individuals who really could hardly care less. So thanks a lot for addressing this, and I'm just going to hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right.
Okay. The caller by regulatory capture means that regulators are heavily influenced by the industry that they're regulating. Now, there could be a number of reasons for this. Oftentimes, regulators build up some expertise in the particular industry that they're regulating, and then there's this revolving door where they, after leaving the regulatory agency, become employed by the industry that they were regulating. That's a relatively common occurrence. And having had some experience dealing with regulatory agencies and sitting in on some discussions of policy, I've come to better appreciate this regulatory capture. I know that it's not only regulators but also legislators that are, I think, subject to pressure from industry groups. Many of the policies, for example, at the FDIC, I know probably would not go forward unless they had approval by banking industry groups. Even small banks, I think, have quite a bit of power through their trade associations, like the Independent Bankers Association, that have pushed for higher deposit insurance limits. When I think, from a public policy point of view, they're probably not justified that we need a $250,000 limit on deposit insurance. I think a lower limit would probably be justified, but there's small banks that rely on an insured deposit base that have really pushed for those types of things, and even larger banks too have a strong influence on regulators and legislators.
You know, one of the things that the administration has proposed is the creation of a new agency that they're calling the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which would be responsible for, I guess, as the name would suggest, for looking out after the interests of consumers. Is there a need for such a thing, do you think?
The spirit of such an agency is probably a good idea. How it works is probably going to be dependent on the details of exactly who's on the agency and what powers they have. In general, I think it's a nice idea to alert consumers to abusive products. The question is whether you can objectively designate what type of financial product is a poor choice for a consumer. You probably can at least put out some information. Hopefully the consumers will look at to see whether a particular financial product is a bad choice or not. Now, this Consumer Financial Protection Agency would go a bit farther in that it could actually outlaw certain products. And, you know, there may be cases where, in fact, that is a good thing and that we're dealing with a relatively unsophisticated population. The financial literacy of many consumers is quite limited, and you could think that this Consumer Financial Protection Agency is acting as a guide to help them make better financial decisions. So the spirit of it is good. Now, again, I just hope that it doesn't go overboard and limit any financial innovation that might be beneficial.
So it's, as far as your understanding is that this would be more than a kind of an educational enterprise, that they would have some regulatory authority.
What the administration is proposing, yes, they would have quite a bit of power to limit certain products, both by banks and non-banks, as well as impose fines. That's one area that is being now discussed in Congress. There's some opposition to the extent of the power that this agency would have. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But it looks likely that we will have some type of Consumer Financial Protection Agency.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is George Pinaki. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about banking regulation and perhaps how things might change and should change as a result of the recent financial crisis that we've been living through. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Over to Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Let me see if I've got this straight. The financial institutions were loaning money to each other, and they were collateralizing their loans by means of debt instruments, and they were judging the value of those debt instruments by the ratings they were getting from the rating institutions. But somehow the rating institutions, the rating that the rating institutions were putting on these debt instruments, used as collateral, was not true. They were saying these debt instruments are AAA debt instruments, and then they defaulted. is that about right? Is that what happened?
That's close to being right. Again, a rating agency. I don't want to defend the rating agencies because I think they were dishonest. Well, there's some research that's going into looking at whether rating agencies, in fact, seem to set ratings based on how much business they were doing with a particular bank or how important a customer that was. There's very limited evidence that perhaps they were doing things dishonestly. I don't think that was the major problem. I think that their models that they were using to rate mortgage-backed securities were limited. They were using historical data on mortgages over decades where housing prices just always rose. I think they did not take into account that we could have had a nationwide downturn in real estate. And, you know, AAA-rated securities, mortgage-backed securities, a number of them have lost value. They actually are few defaults of AAA-rated securities. Lower-rated securities have defaulted in larger numbers. But I think the surprise was not only the downturn in the housing market creating potential losses, but the non-transparency, the opaque nature of these securities made them extremely illiquid. That's the reason why they're often referred to as toxic securities now, is that they were so complicated that whenever there was some downturn in the mortgages backing these securities, it would be just very hard to value the securities because they were made up of parts of mortgage securities that came from other mortgage securities, the so-called collateralized debt obligations that were put together with many other mortgage-backed securities. So I don't think there wasn't an appreciation of the complicated structure of these securities.
So if someone had been brutally honest, he might have said, look, these debt instruments, these instruments that you're using to secure these loans are so complicated, we can't honestly rate them. We don't know how creditworthy they are. Could they have said that?
Yeah, and if they were perhaps more cautious and maybe more honest and maybe had a little bit more foresight that these could turn very illiquid and toxic, then I think that would have gone a long way in alleviating the problem we now face.
Thank you, Vern.
All right, thank you. Over to back here to Urbana and another caller, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Interesting program. It happens that one of my hobbies is reading books about financial scandals. I go back to Daisy Chain. Remember that one about the Texas SNL scandal?
Okay.
And Serpent on the Rock and Liar's Poker was really interesting because here was a chap with no credentials writing financial credentials until he got into the business, writing about how he got into the business and became a manipulator. And then the latest one, the best one for my mind, is The Smartest Guys in the Room, a very long history of Enron. I'll tell you, this discussion today reminds me of that Confucian statue or saying about the three monkeys, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. And I think objectivity and a moderate tone are the best way to inform people. But frankly, I really don't think you can argue that the financial cycle or the boom-bust cycle, whatever you want to call American capital cycle, you have to recognize that money draws disreputable characters like dead meat draws flies. And when the cycle is going into boom times, government agencies, financial institutions, financial advisors, everybody is, well, I'd put it this way, when the economy is tanking, everybody is saying, let's put up some of the screens around the house, keep the flies out. let's put the food away when we're done with it, keep the refrigerator closed, etc. But let prosperity return, and to extend this metaphor tediously, it's government, financial agencies, advisors, and the impulse, the human impulse is to say, well, let's take down some of the screens. They're interfering with ventilation. Let's leave the refrigerator open more often. It doesn't hurt anything, and leave the food on the table. You know, where's the moral dimension in this discussion, folks? And I'll leave that with you.
You make a good point that we've had many financial crises and panics in history. The result is that after a crisis is when we usually have regulatory reform to try to deal with the causes of the previous crisis. Sometimes we don't foresee the next crisis because we feel that, well, we've done what's necessary to prevent crises. But something new always arises. Financial innovation, while it certainly has certain benefits, for example, you know, I think over the last few decades, more people have access to investments such as stocks and bonds through mutual funds. There's more access to credit. Now, you know, whether you think that's good or bad may be an issue, but I think we do now have greater participation by individuals in financial markets. But that financial innovation often leads to money making in some areas, and things are often taken too far. And sometimes we don't realize the defects of financial products until we have a shock such as a bursting of a housing bubble. So perhaps part of the learning process or the process of innovation is that from time to time we're going to make mistakes, and that maybe in the long run is an unavoidable consequence of financial innovation, if indeed you think there are benefits to financial innovation.
We have at least one more call I want to try to get here. Line 2, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. Well, I second the last caller's folksy metaphors on the lacking of this show. I think the quote he might have been looking for is the one that Kevin Phillips used, bad money drives out the good. And I got actually that as a premium for one of the other shows. I recommend that he be on Focus, too, because this issue needs to be discussed. The other names like Michael Hudson and Mark Weisbrot that we're also talking about, not a collapse, but the bubble of housing. So I don't know. I want to second that. But, credit default swaps, when somebody does not have any money in the game, as you call it, or skin in the game, is not a financial innovation. It's called a wager. And there are a lot of people that say this is hard to understand. That part of it, they developed lots of fine equations, et cetera, and instruments. But the idea of itself of making a side bet when you have nothing in the market is and having trillions of dollars circling the globe in that regard, that's not an innovation. That's called gambling, and we know what that does to societies, and it did it here too. I don't know how you'll respond to that, but you did say something at the very beginning that I held on to, which was you're suggesting some kind of value-added tax for banks. Now, I assume you don't mean that you want to add more burdens to the middle class and actually have a value-added tax on sales. You're talking about something that would tax the increase in profit in the value of profits, but we already know that the financial overseer can't get real figures out of where the TARP money went, and we know that that one of the growth industries that is around is manipulating and hiding the profits. That I don't understand how your value added system would work, and I don't know whether that's too esoteric to end on, but I just think that would be manipulated like everything else was. And stop calling these things financial innovations, please.
Well, we got about a minute left. You can respond however you like.
Okay. I would point out that credit default swaps are probably being used as a scapegoat. There's a wide range of securities where someone can speculate or take a bet, probably most trading on the stock markets, or even people will make trades in their 401k plans, mutual funds, in order to speculate. So speculation is a part of all security, almost all security markets. The market for interest rate swaps is far greater than credit default swaps, and yet we haven't had any proposals to limit positions in interest rate swaps. They've actually probably are a bigger danger than credit default swaps. So I think credit default swaps are being maligned. In terms of what I mentioned about a corporate value-added tax, I would suggest that rather than a corporate income tax, a corporate value-added tax would be neutral in terms of a financial institution's choice of debt versus equity capital. And if we move to that type of system, we would have a less prone financial institution that's prone to taking on very high leverage. Our current tax system rewards leverage when indeed we would like just the opposite.
We're going to have to stop. We are here at the end of the time. We'll try and get back to this with some other guests some other days, but for the moment, we got to leave it there. With our thanks to our guest, George Pinaki. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. Thanks.
Thank you very much.